10-year-old. My mom told me these things so that I'd never take for granted how we got to where we were. But none of it ever came from a place of self-pity. "Learn from your past and be better because of your past," she would say. "But don't cry about your past. Life is full of pain. Let the pain sharpen you, but don't hold on to it. Don't be bitter." And she never was. The deprivations of her youth, the betrayals of her parents, she never complained about any of it. Just as she let the past go, she was determined not to repeat it. My childhood would bear no resemblance to hers. She started with my name. The names Xhosa families give their children always have a meaning, and that meaning has a way of becoming self-fulfilling. You have my cousin, Mlungisi, the fixer. That's who he is. Whenever I got into trouble, he was the one trying to help fix it. He was always the good kid, doing chores, helping around the house. You have my uncle, the unplanned pregnancy, Velile, he who popped out of nowhere. And that's all he's done his whole life, disappear and reappear. He'll go off on a drinking binge and then pop back up out of nowhere a week later. Then you have my mother, Patricia Nombuyiselo Noah, she who gives back. That's what she does. She gives and gives and gives. She did it even as a girl in Soweto. Playing in the streets, she would find toddlers, 3- and 4-year-olds, running around unsupervised all day long. Their fathers were gone, and their mothers were drunks. My mom, who was only 6 or 7 herself, used to round up the abandoned kids and form a troop and take them around to the shebeens. They'd collect empties from the men who were passed out and take the bottles to where you could turn them in for deposits. Then, my mom would take that money, buy food in the spaza shops, and feed the kids. She was a child taking care of children. When it was time to pick my name, she chose Trevor, a name with no meaning whatsoever in South Africa, no precedent in my family. It's not even a biblical name. It's just a name. My mother wanted her child beholden to no fate. She wanted me to be free to go anywhere, do anything, be anyone. She gave me the tools to do it as well. She taught me English as my first language. She read to me constantly. The first book I learned to read was the book, the Bible. Church was where we got most of our other books too. My mom would bring home boxes that white people had donated, picture books, chapter books, any book she could get her hands on. Then she signed up for a subscription program where we got books in the mail. It was a series of how-to books. How to be a good friend. How to be honest. She bought a set of encyclopedias, too. It was 15 years old and way out of date, but I would sit and pore through those. My books were my prized possessions. I had a bookshelf where I put them, and I was so proud of it. I loved my books and kept them in pristine condition. I read them over and over, but I did not bend the pages or the spines. I treasured every single one. As I grew older, I started buying my own books. I loved fantasy, loved to get lost in worlds that didn't exist. I remember there was some book about white boys who solved mysteries or some shit. I had no time for that. Give me Roald Dahl, James and the Giant Peach, the BFG, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the wonderful story of Henry Sugar. That was my fix. I had to fight to convince my mom to get the Narnia books for me. She didn't like them. "This lion," she said, "he's a false god, a false idol. You remember what happened when Moses came down from the mountain after he got the tablets?" "Yes, Mom," I explained, "but the lion is a Christ figure. Technically, he is Jesus. It's a story to explain Jesus." She wasn't comfortable with that. "No, no, no false idols, my friend." Eventually, I wore her down. That was a big win. If my mother had one goal, it was to free my mind. My mother spoke to me like an adult, which was unusual. In South Africa, kids play with kids and adults talk to adults. The adults supervise you, but they don't get down on your level and talk to you. My mom did, all the time. I was like her best friend. She was always telling me stories, giving me lessons, Bible lessons especially. She was big into Psalms. I had to read Psalms every day. She would quiz me on it. "What does the passage mean? What does it mean to you? How do you apply it to your life?" that was every day of my life. My mom did what school didn't. She taught me how to think. The end of apartheid was a gradual thing. It wasn't like the Berlin Wall where one day it just came down. Apartheid's walls cracked and crumbled over many years. Concessions were made here and there. Some laws were repealed, others simply weren't enforced. There came a point in the months before Mandela's release when we could live less furtively. It was then that my mother decided we needed to move. She felt we had grown as much as we could hiding in our tiny flat in town. The country was open now. Where would we go? Soweto came with its burdens. My mother still wanted to get out from the shadow of her family. My mother also couldn't walk with me through Soweto without people saying, "There goes that prostitute with the white man's child." In a black area, she would always be seen as that. So, since my mom didn't want to move to a black area and couldn't afford to move to a white area, she decided to move to a colored area. Eden Park was a colored neighborhood adjacent to several black townships on the East Rand. Half colored and half black, she figured, like us. We'd be camouflaged there. It didn't work out that way. We never fit in at all. But that was her thinking when we made the move. Plus, it was a chance to buy a home, our own home. Eden Park was one of those suburbs that are actually out on the edge of civilization, the kind of place where property developers have said, "Hey, poor people, you can live the good life too. Here's a house in the middle of nowhere, but look, you have a yard." For some reason, the streets in Eden Park were named after cars. Jaguar Street, Ferrari Street, Honda Street. I don't know if that was a coincidence or not, but it's funny because colored people in South Africa are known for loving fancy cars. It was like living in a white neighborhood with all the streets named after varietals of fine wine. I remember moving out there in flashbacks, snippets, driving to a place I'd never seen, seeing people I'd never seen. It was flat, not many trees, the same dusty red clay dirt and grass as Soweto, but with proper houses and paved roads, and a sense of suburbia to it. Ours was a tiny house at the bend in the road right off Toyota Street. It was modest and cramped inside. But walking in, I thought, wow, we are really living. It was crazy to have my own room. I didn't like it. My whole life I'd slept in a room with my mom or on the floor with my cousins. I was used to having other human beings right next to me. So I slept in my mom's bed most nights. There was no stepfather in the picture yet. No baby brother crying in the night. It was me and her, alone. There was the sense of the two of us embarking on a grand adventure. She'd say things to me like, "It's you and me against the world." I understood even from an early age that we weren't just mother and son. We were a team. It was when we moved to Eden Park that we finally got a car. The beat-up tangerine Volkswagen my mother bought secondhand for next to nothing. One out of five times, it wouldn't start. There was no AC. Anytime I made the mistake of turning on the fan, the vent would fart bits of leaves and dust all over me. Whenever it broke down, we'd catch minibuses or sometimes we'd hitchhike. She'd make me hide in the bushes because she knew men would stop for a woman, but not a woman with a child. She'd stand by the road, the driver would pull over. She'd open the door and then whistle, and I'd come running up to the car. I would watch their faces drop as they realized they weren't picking up an attractive single woman, but an attractive single woman with a fat little kid. When the car did work, we had the windows down, sputtering along and baking in the heat. For my entire life, the dial on that car's radio stayed on one station. It was called Radio Pulpit. And as the name suggests, it was nothing but preaching and praise. I wasn't allowed to touch that dial. Anytime the radio wasn't getting reception, my mom would pop in a cassette of Jimmy Swaggart's sermons. When we finally found out about the scandal, oh man, that was rough. But as shitty as our car was, it was a car. It was freedom. We weren't black people stuck in the townships waiting for public transport. We were black people who were out in the world. We were black people who could wake up and say, "Where do we choose to go today?" On the commute to work and school, there was a long stretch of the road into town that was completely deserted. That's where Mom would let me drive. On the highway. I was 6. She'd put me on her lap and let me steer and work the indicators while she worked the pedals and the stick shift. After a few months of that, she taught me how to work the stick. She was still working the clutch, but I'd climb onto her lap and take the stick, and she'd call out the gears as we drove. There was this one part of the road that ran deep into a valley and then back up on the other side. We'd get up ahead of speed, and we'd stick it into neutral and let go of the brake and the clutch, and woo! We'd race down the hill, and then zoom, we'd shoot up the other side. We were flying. If we weren't at school or work or church, we were out exploring. My mom's attitude was, I chose you, kid. I brought you into this world, and I'm going to give you everything I never had. She poured herself into me. She would find places for us to go where we didn't have to spend money. We must have gone to every park in Johannesburg. My mom would sit under a tree and read the Bible, and I'd run and play and play and play. On Sunday afternoons after church, we'd go for drives out in the country. My mom would find places with beautiful views for us to sit and have a picnic. There was none of the fanfare of a picnic basket or plates or anything like that, only bologna and brown bread and margarine sandwiches wrapped up in butcher paper. To this day, bologna and brown bread and margarine will instantly take me back. You can come with all the Michelin stars in the world. Just give me bologna and brown bread and margarine, and I'm in heaven. Food, or the access to food, was always the measure of how good or bad things were going in our lives. My mom would always say, my job is to feed your body, feed your spirit, and feed your mind. And that's exactly what she did. And the way she found money for food and books was to spend absolutely nothing on anything else. Her frugality was the stuff of legend. Our car was a tin can on wheels, and we lived in the middle of nowhere. We had threadbare furniture, busted old sofas with holes worn through the fabric. Our TV was a tiny black and white with a bunny aerial on top. We changed the channels using a pair of pliers because the buttons didn't work. Most of the time, you had to squint to see what was going on. We always wore secondhand clothes from Goodwill stores or that were giveaways from white people at church. All the other kids at school got brands, Nike and Adidas. I never got brands. One time I asked my mom for Adidas sneakers. She came home with some knockoff brand, Abidas. Mom, these are fake, I said. I don't see the difference. Look at the logo. There are 4 stripes instead of 3. Lucky you, she said. You got 1 extra. We got by with next to nothing. But we always had church, and we always had books, and we always had food. Mind you, it wasn't necessarily good food. Meat was a luxury. When things were going well, we'd have chicken. My mom was an expert at cracking open a chicken bone and getting out every last bit of the marrow inside. We didn't eat chickens. We obliterated them. Our family was an archaeologist's nightmare. We left no bones behind. When we were done with the chicken, there was nothing left but the head. Sometimes, the only meat we had was packaged meat that you buy at the butcher called sawdust. It was literally the dust of the meat, the bits that fell off the cuts being packaged for the shop, the bits of fat and whatever's left. They'd sweep it up and put it into bags. It was meant for dogs, but my mom bought it for us. There were many months where that was all we ate. The butcher sold bones, too. We called them soup bones, but they were actually labeled dog bones in the store. People would cook them for their dogs as a treat. Whenever times were really tough, we'd fall back on dog bones. My mom would boil them for soup. We'd suck the marrow out of them. Sucking marrow out of bones is a skill poor people learn early. I'll never forget the first time I went to a fancy restaurant as a grown man, and someone told me, "You have to try the bone marrow. It's such a delicacy. It's divine." They ordered it. The waiter brought it out, and I was like, dog bones, motherfucker? I was not impressed. As modestly as we lived at home, I never felt poor, because our lives were so rich with experience. We were always out, doing something, going somewhere. My mom used to take me on drives through fancy white neighborhoods. We'd go look at people's houses, look at their mansions. We'd look at their walls, mostly, because that's all we could see from the road. We'd look at a wall that ran from one end of the block to the other and go, wow, that's only one house? All of that is for one family? Sometimes, we'd pull over and go up to the wall, and she'd put me up on her shoulders like I was a little periscope. I would look into the yards and describe everything I was seeing. "It's a big white house. They have two dogs. There's a lemon tree. They have a swimming pool and a tennis court." My mother took me to places black people never went. She refused to be bound by ridiculous ideas of what black people couldn't or shouldn't do. She'd take me to the ice rink to go skating. Johannesburg used to have this epic drive-in movie theater, Top Star Drive-In, on top of a massive mine dump outside the city. She'd take me to movies there. We'd get snacks, hang the speaker on our car window. Top Star had a 360-degree view of the city, the suburbs, Soweto. Up there, I could see for miles in every direction. I felt like I was on top of the world. My mom raised me as if there were no limitations on where I could go or what I could do. When I look back, I realize she raised me like a white kid. Not white culturally, but in the sense of believing that the world was my oyster, that I should speak up for myself, that my ideas and thoughts and decisions mattered. We tell people to follow their dreams, but you can only dream of what you can imagine. And depending on where you come from, your imagination can be quite limited. Growing up in Soweto, our dream was to put another room on our house, maybe have a driveway, maybe someday a cast iron gate at the end of the driveway, because that was all we knew. But the highest rung of what's possible is far beyond the world you can see. My mother showed me what was possible. The thing that always amazed me about her life was that no one showed her. No one chose her. She did it on her own. She found her way through sheer force of will. Perhaps even more amazing is the fact that my mother started her little project, me, at a time when she could not have known that apartheid would end. There was no reason to think it would end. It had seen generations come and go. I was nearly 6 when Mandela was released, 10 before democracy finally came. Yet she was preparing me to live a life of freedom long before we knew freedom would exist. A hard life in the township or a trip to the colored orphanage were the far more likely options on the table. But we never lived that way. We only moved forward, and we always moved fast. And by the time the law and everyone else came around, we were already miles down the road, flying across the freeway in a bright orange piece-of-shit Volkswagen with the windows down and Jimmy Swaggart praising Jesus at the top of his lungs. People thought my mom was crazy. Ice rinks and drive-ins and suburbs. These things were izinto zabelungu, the things of white people. So many black people had internalized the logic of apartheid and made it their own. Why teach a black child white things? Neighbors and relatives used to pester my mom. "Why do all this? Why show him the world when he's never going to leave the ghetto?" "Because," she would say, "even if he never leaves the ghetto, he will know that the ghetto is not the world. If that's all I accomplish, I've done enough." Apartheid, for all its power, had fatal flaws baked in, starting with the fact that it never made any sense. Racism is not logical. Consider this. Chinese people were classified as black in South Africa. I don't mean they were running around acting black. They were still Chinese. But unlike Indians, there weren't enough Chinese people to warrant devising a whole separate classification. Apartheid, despite its intricacies and precision, didn't know what to do with them. So the government said, we'll just call them black. It's simpler that way. Interestingly, at the same time, Japanese people were labeled as white. The reason for this was that the South African government wanted to establish good relations with the Japanese in order to import their fancy cars and electronics. So Japanese people were given honorary white status, while Chinese people stayed black. I always like to imagine being a South African policeman who likely couldn't tell the difference between Chinese and Japanese, but whose job was to make sure that people of the wrong color weren't doing the wrong thing. If he saw an Asian person sitting on a whites-only bench, what would he say? Hey, get off that bench, you Chinaman.
Excuse me, I'm Japanese.
Oh, I apologize, sir. I didn't mean to be racist. Have a lovely afternoon.
6. Loopholes.
My mother used to tell me, I chose to have you because I wanted something to love and something that would love me unconditionally in return. And then I gave birth to the most selfish piece of shit on earth, and all it ever did was cry and eat and shit and say, me, 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 me. My mom thought having a child was going to be like having a partner. But every child is born the center of its own universe, incapable of understanding the world beyond its own wants and needs. And I was no different. I was a voracious kid. I consumed boxes of books and wanted more, more, more. I ate like a pig. The way I ate, I should have been obese. At a certain point, the family thought I had worms. Whenever I went to my cousin's house for the holidays, my mom would drop me off with a bag of tomatoes, onions and potatoes, and a large sack of cornmeal. That was her way of preempting any complaints about my visits. At my gran's house, I always got seconds, which none of the other kids got. My grandmother would give me the pot and say, "Finish it." If you didn't want to wash the dishes, you called Trevor. They called me the rubbish bin of the family. I ate and ate and ate. I was hyperactive, too. I craved constant stimulation and activity. When I walked down the sidewalk as a toddler, if you didn't have my arm in a death grip, I was off, running full speed toward the traffic. I loved to be chased. I thought it was a game. The old grannies my mom hired to look after me while she was at work, I would leave them in tears. My mom would come home and they'd be crying. "I quit. I can't do this. Your son is a tyrant." It was the same with my school teachers, with Sunday school teachers. If you weren't engaging me, you were in trouble. I wasn't a shit to people. I wasn't whiny and spoiled. I had good manners. I was just high energy and knew what I wanted to do. My mom used to take me to the park so she could run me to death and burn off the energy. She'd take a frisbee and throw it, and I'd run and catch it and bring it back, over and over and over. Sometimes she'd throw a tennis ball. Black people's dogs don't play fetch. You don't throw anything to a black person's dog unless it's food. So it was only when I started spending time in parks with white people and their pets that I realized my mom was training me like a dog. Anytime my extra energy wasn't burned off, it would find its way into general naughtiness and misbehavior. I prided myself on being the ultimate prankster. Every teacher at school used overhead projectors to put their notes up on the wall during class. One day, I went around and took the magnifying glass out of every projector in every classroom. Another time, I emptied a fire extinguisher into the school piano because I knew we were going to have a performance at assembly the next day. The pianist sat down and played the first note, and foam, all this foam exploded out of the piano. The two things I loved most were fire and knives. I was endlessly fascinated by them. Knives were just cool. I collected them from pawn shops and garage sales. Flick knives, butterfly knives, the Rambo knife, the Crocodile Dundee knife. Fire was the ultimate, though. I loved fire, and I especially loved fireworks. We celebrated Guy Fawkes Day in November, and every year my mom would buy us a ton of fireworks, like a mini arsenal. I realized that I could take the gunpowder out of all the fireworks and create one massive firework of my own. One afternoon, I was doing precisely that, goofing around with my cousin and filling an empty plant pot with a huge pile of gunpowder when I got distracted by some black cat firecrackers. The cool thing you could do with a black cat was, instead of lighting it to make it explode, you could break it in half and light it, and it would turn into a mini flamethrower. I stopped midway through building my gunpowder pile to play with the black cats and somehow dropped a match into the pile. The whole thing exploded, throwing a massive ball of flame up in my face. Mlungisi screamed and my mom came running into the yard in a panic. "What happened?" I played it cool, even though I could still feel the heat of the fireball on my face. "Oh, nothing. Nothing happened.
Were you playing with fire?
No. She shook her head.
You know what? I would beat you, but Jesus has already exposed your lies.
Huh?
Go to the bathroom and look at yourself.
I went to the toilet and looked in the mirror. My eyebrows were gone, and the front inch or so of my hair was completely burned off. From an adult's point of view, I was destructive and out of control. But as a child, I didn't think of it that way. I never wanted to destroy. I wanted to create. I wasn't burning my eyebrows. I was creating fire. I wasn't breaking overhead projectors. I was creating chaos to see how people reacted. And I couldn't help it. There's a condition kids suffer from, a compulsive disorder that makes them do things they themselves don't understand. You can tell a child, whatever you do, don't draw on the wall. You can draw on this paper. You can draw in this book. You can draw on any surface you want, but do not draw or write or color on the wall. The child will look you dead in the eye and say, "Got it." 10 minutes later, the child is drawing on the wall. You start screaming, "Why the hell are you drawing on the wall?" The child looks at you and he genuinely has no idea why he drew on the wall. As a kid, I remember having that feeling all the time. Every time I got punished as my mom was whipping my ass, I'd be thinking, "Why did I just do that? I knew not to do that. She told me not to do that." Then once the hiding was over, I'd say to myself, "I'm going to be so good from here on. I'm never, ever going to do a bad thing in my life. Ever, 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 ever. And to remember not to do anything bad, let me write something on the wall to remind myself." And then I would pick up a crayon and get straight back into it, and I never understood why. My relationship with my mom was like the relationship between a cop and a criminal in the movies, the relentless detective and the devious mastermind she's determined to catch. They're bitter rivals, but damn, they respect the hell out of each other. And somehow, they even grow to like each other. Sometimes my mom would catch me, but she was usually one step behind, and she was always giving me the eye. "Someday, kid. Someday I'm going to catch you and put you away for the rest of your life." Then I would give her a nod in return. "Have a good evening, officer." That was my whole childhood. My mom was forever trying to rein me in. Over the years, her tactics grew more and more sophisticated. Where I had youth and energy on my side, she had cunning. And she figured out different ways to keep me in line. One Sunday, we were at the shops, and there was a big display of toffee apples. I loved toffee apples, and I kept nagging her the whole way through the shop. "Please, can I have a toffee apple? Please, can I have a toffee apple? Please, can I have a toffee apple? Please, can I have a toffee apple?" Finally, once we had our groceries and my mom was heading to the front to pay, I succeeded in wearing her down. "Fine," she said. "Go and get a toffee apple." I ran, got a toffee apple, came back, and put it on the counter at checkout. "Add this toffee apple, please," I said. The cashier looked at me skeptically. "Wait your turn, boy. I'm still helping this lady." "No," I said. "She's buying it for me." My mother turned to me.
"Who's buying it for you?"
"You're buying it for me."
"No, no. Why doesn't your mother buy it for you?"
"What? My mother? You're my mother."
"I'm your mother? No, I'm not your mother. Where's your mother?" I was so confused.
"You're my mother."
The cashier looked at her, looked back at me, looked at her again. She shrugged like, "I have no idea what that kid's talking about." Then she looked at me like she'd never seen me before in her life.
"Are you lost, little boy? Where's your mother?"
"Yeah," the cashier said. "Where's your mother?"
I pointed at my mother.
"She's my mother." "What? She can't be your mother, boy. She's black, can't you see?"
My mom shook her head.
"Poor little colored boy lost his mother. What a shame."
I panicked. Was I crazy? Is she not my mother?
I started bawling. "You're my mother. You're my mother. She's my mother. She's my mother."
She shrugged again. "So sad. I hope he finds his mother." The cashier nodded. She paid him, took our groceries, and walked out of the shop. I dropped the toffee apple, ran out behind her in tears, and caught up to her at the car. She turned around, laughing hysterically, like she'd really got me good.
"Why are you crying?" she asked. "Because you said you weren't my mother. Why did you say you weren't my mother?"
"Because you wouldn't shut up about the toffee apple. Now get in the car. Let's go." By the time I was 7 or 8, I was too smart to be tricked. So she changed tactics. Our life turned into a courtroom drama with two lawyers constantly debating over loopholes and technicalities. My mom was smart and had a sharp tongue, but I was quicker in an argument. She'd get flustered because she couldn't keep up. So she started writing me letters. That way, she could make her points, and there could be no verbal sparring back and forth. If I had chores to do, I'd come home to find an envelope slipped under the door, like from the landlord. "Dear Trevor, children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord." Colossians 3 verse 20. "There are certain things I expect from you as my child and as a young man. You need to clean your room. You need to keep the house clean. You need to look after your school uniform. Please, my child, I ask you, respect my rules so that I may also respect you. I ask you now, please go and do the dishes and do the weeds in the garden. Yours sincerely, Mom." I would do my chores, and if I had anything to say, I would write back. Because my mom was a secretary and I spent hours at her office every day after school, I'd learned a great deal about business correspondence. I was extremely proud of my letter-writing abilities.
"To whom it may concern. Dear Mom, I have received your correspondence earlier. I am delighted to say that I am ahead of schedule on the dishes, and I will continue to wash them in an hour or so. Please note that the garden is wet, and so I cannot do the weeds at this time. But please be assured this task will be completed by the end of the weekend. Also, I completely agree with what you are saying with regard to my respect levels, and I will maintain my room to a satisfactory standard. Yours sincerely, Trevor."
Those were the polite letters. If we were having a real full-on argument, or if I'd gotten into trouble at school, I'd find more accusatory missives waiting for me when I got home. "Dear Trevor, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of discipline will remove it far from him." Proverbs 22 verse 15. "Your school marks this term have been very disappointing, and your behavior in class continues to be disruptive and disrespectful. It is clear from your actions that you do not respect me. You do not respect your teachers. Learn to respect the women in your life. The way you treat me and the way you treat your teachers will be the way you treat other women in the world. Learn to buck that trend now, and you will be a better man because of it. Because of your behavior, I am grounding you for 1 week. There will be no television and no video games. Yours sincerely, Mom." I, of course, would find this punishment completely unfair. I'd take the letter and confront her. "Can I speak to you about this?" "No. If you want to reply, you have to write a letter." I'd go to my room, get out a pen and paper, sit at my little desk, and go after her arguments one by one. "To whom it may concern. Dear Mom, first of all, this has been a particularly tough time in school, and for you to say that my marks are bad is extremely unfair, especially considering the fact that you yourself were not very good in school, and I am, after all, a product of yours. And so, in part, you are to blame, because if you were not good in school, why would I be good in school? Because genetically, we are the same. Gran always talks about how naughty you were, so obviously my naughtiness comes from you. So I don't think it is right or just for you to say any of this. Yours sincerely, Trevor." I'd bring her the letter and stand there while she read it. Invariably, she'd tear it up and throw it in the dustbin. "Rubbish. This is rubbish." Then she'd start to launch into me and I'd say, no, you have to write a letter." Then I'd go to my room and wait for her reply. This sometimes went back and forth for days. The letter writing was for minor disputes. For major infractions, My mom went with the ass-whipping. Like most black South African parents, when it came to discipline, my mom was old school. If I pushed her too far, she'd go for the belt or switch. That's just how it was in those days. Pretty much all of my friends had it the same. My mom would have given me proper sit-down hidings if I'd given her the opportunity, but she could never catch me. My gran called me Springbok, after the second fastest land mammal on earth, the deer that the cheetah hunts. My mom had to become a guerrilla fighter. She got her licks in where she could, her belt or maybe a shoe administered on the fly. One thing I respected about my mom was that she never left me in any doubt as to why I was receiving the hiding. It wasn't rage or anger. It was discipline from a place of love. My mom was on her own with a crazy child. I destroyed pianos. I shat on floors. I would screw up. She'd beat the shit out of me and give me time to cry. And then she'd pop back into my room with a big smile and go, "Are you ready for dinner? We need to hurry and eat if we want to watch Rescue 911. Are you coming?" "What? What kind of psychopath are you? You just beat me." "Yes, because you did something wrong. It doesn't mean I don't love you anymore." "What? Look, did you or did you not do something wrong?"
"I did."
"And then I hit you. And now that's over. So why sit there and cry? It's time for Rescue 911. William Shatner is waiting. Are you coming or not?" When it came to discipline, Catholic school was no joke. Whenever I got into trouble with the nuns at Maryvale College, they'd rap me on the knuckles with the edge of a metal ruler. For cursing, they'd wash my mouth out with soap. For serious offenses, I'd get sent to the principal's office. Only the principal could give you an official hiding. You'd have to bend over, and he'd hit your ass with this flat rubber thing like the sole of a shoe. Whenever the principal would hit me, it was like he was afraid to do it too hard. One day, I was getting a hiding, and I thought, "Man, if only my mom hit me like this." And I started laughing. I couldn't help it. The principal was quite disturbed. "If you're laughing while you're getting beaten," he said, "then something is definitely wrong with you." That was the first of three times the school made my mom take me to a psychologist to be evaluated. Every psychologist who examined me came back and said, "There's nothing wrong with this kid." I wasn't ADD. I wasn't a sociopath. I was just creative and independent and full of energy. The therapists did give me a series of tests, and they came to the conclusion that I was either going to make an excellent criminal or be very good at catching criminals, because I could always find loopholes in the law. Whenever I thought a rule wasn't logical, I'd find my way around it. The rules about communion at Friday Mass, for example, made absolutely no sense. We'd be in there for an hour, kneeling, standing, sitting, kneeling, standing, sitting, kneeling, standing, sitting, and by the end of it, I'd be starving. But I was never allowed to take communion, because I wasn't Catholic. The other kids could eat Jesus' body and drink Jesus' blood, but I couldn't. And Jesus' blood was grape juice. I loved grape juice. Grape juice and crackers. What more could a kid want? And they wouldn't let me have any. I'd argue with the nuns and the priest all the time. "Only Catholics can eat Jesus' body and drink Jesus' blood, right?"
"Yes." "But Jesus wasn't Catholic."
"No."
"Jesus was Jewish."
"Well, yes."
"So you're telling me that if Jesus walked into your church right now, Jesus would not be allowed to have the body and the blood of Jesus?"
"Well, They never had a satisfactory reply. One morning before Mass, I decided, I'm going to get me some Jesus blood and Jesus body. I snuck up behind the altar, and I drank the entire bottle of grape juice, and I ate the entire bag of Eucharist to make up for all the other times that I couldn't. In my mind, I wasn't breaking the rules, because the rules didn't make any sense, and I got caught only because they broke their own rules. Another kid ratted me out in confession, and the priest turned me in.
No, no, I protested. You've broken the rules. That's confidential information. The priest isn't supposed to repeat what you say in confession.
They didn't care. The school could break whatever rules it wanted. The principal laid into me.
What kind of a sick person would eat all of Jesus' body and drink all of Jesus' blood? A hungry person.
I got another hiding, and a second trip to the psychologist for that one. The third visit to the shrink and the last straw came in grade 6. A kid was bullying me. He said he was going to beat me up, and I brought one of my knives to school. I wasn't going to use it. I just wanted to have it. The school didn't care. That was the last straw for them. I wasn't expelled exactly. The principal sat me down and said, "Trevor, we can expel you. You need to think hard about whether you really want to be at Merivale next year." I think he thought he was giving me an ultimatum that would get me to shape up, but I felt like he was offering me an out, and I took it. "No," I told him, "I don't want to be here." And that was the end of Catholic school. Funnily enough, I didn't get into trouble with my mom when it happened. There was no ass-whipping waiting for me at home. She'd lost the bursary when she'd left her job at ICI, and paying for private school was becoming a burden. But more than that, she thought the school was overreacting. The truth is, she probably took my side against Merivale more often than not. She agreed with me 100% about the Eucharist thing.
"Let me get this straight," she told the principal. "You're punishing a child because he wants Jesus' body and Jesus' blood. Why shouldn't he have those things? Of course he should have them."
When they made me see a therapist for laughing while the principal hit me, she told the school that was ridiculous too. "Mrs. Noah, your son was laughing while we were hitting him." "Well, clearly you don't know how to hit a kid. That's your problem, not mine. Trevor's never laughed when I've hit him, I can tell you." That was the weird and kind of amazing thing about my mom. If she agreed with me that a rule was stupid, she wouldn't punish me for breaking it. Both she and the psychologists agreed that the school was the one with the problem, not me. Catholic school is not the place to be creative and independent. Catholic school is similar to apartheid in that it's ruthlessly authoritarian, and its authority rests on a bunch of rules that don't make any sense. My mother grew up with these rules, and she questioned them. When they didn't hold up, she simply went around them. The only authority my mother recognized was God's. God is love, and the Bible is truth. Everything else was up for debate. She taught me to challenge authority and question the system. The only way it backfired on her was that I constantly challenged and questioned her. When I was 7 years old, my mother had been dating her new boyfriend, Abel, for a year, maybe. But at that point, I was too young to know who they were to each other. It was just, "Hey, that's Mom's friend who's around a lot." I liked Abel. He was a really nice guy. As a black person back then, if you wanted to live in the suburbs, you'd have to find a white family renting out their servants' quarters, or sometimes their garage, which was what Abel had done. He lived in a neighborhood called Orange Grove, in a white family's garage, which he'd turned into a cottage-type thing with a hot plate and a bed. Sometimes he'd come sleep at our house, and sometimes we'd go stay with him. Staying in a garage when we owned our own house wasn't ideal, but Orange Grove was close to my school and my mom's work, so it had its benefits. This white family also had a black maid who lived in the servants' quarters in the backyard, and I'd play with her son whenever we stayed there. At that age, my love of fire was in full bloom. One afternoon, everyone was at work, my mom and Abel and both of the white parents, and the kid and I were playing together while his mom was inside the house cleaning. One thing I loved doing at the time was using a magnifying glass to burn my name into pieces of wood. You had to aim the lens and get the focus just right, and then you got the flame, and then you moved it slowly and you could burn shapes and letters and patterns. I was fascinated by it. That afternoon, I was teaching this kid how to do it. We were inside the servants' quarters, which was really more of a tool shed added onto the back of the house, full of wooden ladders, buckets of old paint, turpentine. I had a box of matches with me too, all my usual fire-making tools. We were sitting on an old mattress that they used to sleep on the floor, basically a sack stuffed with dried straw. The sun was beaming in through the window, and I was showing the kid how to burn his name into a piece of plywood. At one point, we took a break to go get a snack. I set the magnifying glass and the matches on the mattress, and we left. When we came back a few minutes later, we found the shed had one of those doors that self-locks from the inside. We couldn't get back in without going to get his mother, so we decided to run around and play in the yard. After a while, I noticed smoke coming out of the cracks in the window frame. I ran over and looked inside. A small fire was burning in the middle of the straw mattress where we'd left the matches and the magnifying glass. We ran and called the maid. She came, but didn't know what to do. The door was locked. And before we could figure out how to get into the shed, the whole thing caught. The mattress, the ladders, the paint, the turpentine, everything. The flames moved quickly. Soon the roof was on fire, and from there the blaze spread to the main house, and the whole thing burned and burned. Smoke was billowing into the sky. A neighbor had called the fire brigade and the sirens were on their way. Me and this kid and the maid, we ran out to the road and watched as the firemen tried to put it out. But by the time they did, it was too late. There was nothing left but a charred brick-and-mortar shell, roof gone and gutted from the inside. The White family came home and stood on the street, staring at the ruins of their house. They asked the maid what happened, and she asked her son, and the kid totally snitched. "Trevor had matches," he said. The family said nothing to me. I don't think they knew what to say. They were completely dumbfounded. They didn't call the police, didn't threaten to sue. What were they going to do? Arrest a 7-year-old for arson? And we were so poor, you couldn't actually sue us for anything. Plus, they had insurance. So that was the end of it. They kicked Abel out of the garage, which I thought was hilarious because the garage, which was freestanding, was the only piece of the property left unscathed. I saw no reason for Abel to have to leave, but they made him. We packed up his stuff, put it into our car, and drove home to Eden Park. Abel basically lived with us from then on. He and my mom got into a huge fight. "Your son has burned down my life." But there was no punishment for me that day. My mom was too much in shock. There's naughty, and then there's burning down a white person's house. She didn't know what to do. I didn't feel bad about it at all. I still don't. The lawyer in me maintains that I'm completely innocent. There were matches, and there was a magnifying glass, and there was a mattress, and then clearly a series of unfortunate events. Things catch fire sometimes. That's why there's a fire brigade. But everyone in my family will tell you, Trevor burned down a house. If people thought I was naughty before, after the fire, I was notorious. One of my uncles stopped calling me Trevor. He called me Terra instead. "Don't leave that kid alone in your home," he'd say. "He'll burn it to the ground." My cousin Mlungisi, to this day, cannot comprehend how I survived being as naughty as I was for as long as I did. How I withstood the number of hidings that I got. Why did I keep misbehaving? How did I never learn my lesson? Both of my cousins were super good kids. Mlungisi got maybe one hiding in his life. After that, he said he never wanted to experience anything like it ever again. And from that day, he always followed the rules. But I was blessed with another trait I inherited from my mother. Her ability to forget the pain in life. I remember the thing that caused the trauma, but I don't hold on to the trauma. I never let the memory of something painful prevent me from trying something new. If you think too much about the ass-kicking your mom gave you, or the ass-kicking that life gave you, you'll stop pushing the boundaries and breaking the rules. It's better to take it, spend some time crying, than wake up the next day and move on. You'll have a few bruises, and they'll remind you of what happened, and that's okay. But after a while, the bruises fade, and they fade for a reason. Because now, it's time to get up to some shit again. I grew up in a black family, in a black neighborhood, in a black country. I've traveled to other black cities and black countries all over the black continent. And in all of that time, I've yet to find a place where black people like cats. One of the biggest reasons for that, as we know in South Africa, is that only witches have cats. And all cats are witches. There was a famous incident during an Orlando Pirates soccer match a few years ago. A cat got into the stadium and ran through the crowd and out onto the pitch in the middle of the game. A security guard, seeing the cat, did what any sensible black person would do. He said to himself, "That cat is a witch." He caught the cat, and live on TV, he kicked it and stomped it and beat it to death with a shambok, a hard leather whip. It was front page news all over the country. White people lost their shit. Oh my word, it was insane. The security guard was arrested and put on trial and found guilty of animal abuse. He had to pay some enormous fine to avoid spending several months in jail. What was ironic to me was that white people had spent years seeing video of black people being beaten to death by other white people. But this one video of a black man kicking a cat, that's what sent them over the edge. Black people were just confused. They didn't see any problem with what the man did. They were like, obviously, that cat was a witch. How else would a cat know how to get onto a soccer pitch? Somebody sent it to jinx one of the teams. That man had to kill the cat. He was protecting the players. In South Africa, black people have dogs. 7. Fufi. A month after we moved to Eden Park, my mother brought home two cats. Black cats. Beautiful creatures. Some woman from her work had a litter of kittens she was trying to get rid of, and my mom ended up with two. I was excited because I'd never had a pet before. My mom was excited because she loves animals. She didn't believe in any nonsense about cats. It was just another way in which she was a rebel, refusing to conform to ideas about what black people did and didn't do. In a black neighborhood, you wouldn't dare own a cat, especially a black cat. That would be like wearing a sign that said, "Hello, I am a witch." That would be suicide. Since we'd moved to a colored neighborhood, my mom thought the cats would be okay. Once they were grown, we let them out during the day to roam the neighborhood. Then we came home one evening and found the cats strung up by their tails from our front gate, gutted and skinned and bleeding out, their heads chopped off. On our front wall, someone had written in Afrikaans, "Hex, witch." Colored people apparently were no more progressive than black people on the issue of cats. I wasn't exactly devastated about the cats. I don't think we'd had them long enough for me to get attached. I don't even remember their names. And cats are dicks for the most part. As much as I tried, they never felt like real pets. They never showed me affection, nor did they accept any of mine. Had the cats made more of an effort, I might have felt like I had lost something. But even as a kid, looking at these dead, mutilated animals, I was like, well, there you have it. Maybe if they'd been nicer, they could have avoided this. After the cats were killed, we took a break from pets for a while. Then we got dogs. Dogs are cool. Almost every black family I knew had a dog. No matter how poor you were, you had a dog. White people treat dogs like children or members of the family. Black people's dogs are more for protection, a poor man's alarm system. You buy a dog and you keep it out in the yard. Black people name dogs by their traits. If it has stripes, you call it tiger. If it's vicious, you call it danger. If it has spots, you call it spotty. Given the finite number of traits a dog can have, pretty much everyone's dogs have the same names. People just recycle them. We never had dogs in Soweto. Then one day, some lady at my mom's work offered us two puppies. They weren't planned puppies. This woman's Maltese poodle had been impregnated by the bull terrier from next door. A strange mix. My mom said she'd take them both. She brought them home, and I was the happiest kid on earth. My mom named them Fufi and Panther. Fufi, I don't know where her name came from. Panther had a pink nose, so she was Pink Panther, and eventually just Panther. They were two sisters who loved and hated each other. They would look out for each other, but they would also fight all the time, like blood fights, biting, clawing. It was a strange, gruesome relationship. Panther was my mom's dog. Fufi was mine. Fufi was beautiful, clean lines, happy face. She looked like a perfect bull terrier, only skinnier because of the Maltese mixed in. Panther, who was more half and half, came out weird and scruffy looking. Panther was smart. Fufi was dumb as shit. At least we always thought she was dumb as shit. Whenever we called them, Panther would come right away. But Fufi wouldn't do anything. Panther would run back and get Fufi, and then they'd both come. It turned out that Fufi was deaf. Years later, Fufi died when a burglar was trying to break into our house. He pushed the gate over and it fell on her back and broke her spine. We took her to the vet and she had to be put down. After examining her, The vet came over and gave us the news.
It must have been strange for your family living with a dog that was deaf, he said.
What?
You didn't know your dog was deaf?
No, we thought it was stupid. That's when we realized that their whole lives, the one dog had been telling the other dog what to do somehow. The smart hearing one was helping the dumb deaf one. Fufi was the love of my life. Beautiful but stupid. I raised her. I potty trained her. She slept in my bed. A dog is a great thing for a kid to have. It's like a bicycle, but with emotions. Fufi could do all sorts of tricks. She could jump super high. I mean, Fufi could jump. I could hold a piece of food out above my own head, and she'd leap up and grab it like it was nothing. If YouTube had been around, Fufi would have been a star. Fufi was a little rascal as well. During the day, we kept the dogs in the backyard, which was enclosed by a wall at least 5 feet high. After a while, every day we'd come home, and Fufi would be sitting outside the gates waiting for us. We were always confused. Was someone opening the gates? What was going on? It never occurred to us that she could actually scale a 5-foot wall, but that was exactly what was happening. Every morning, Fufi would wait for us to leave, jump over the wall, and go roaming around the neighborhood. I caught her one day when I was home for the school holidays. My mom had left for work, and I was in the living room. Fufi didn't know I was there. She thought I was gone, because the car was gone. I heard Panther barking in the backyard, looked out, and there was Fufi, scaling the wall. She jumped, scampered up the last couple of feet, and then she was gone. I couldn't believe this was happening. I ran out front, grabbed my bicycle, and followed her to see where she was going. She went a long way, many streets over, to another part of the neighborhood. Then she went up to this other house and jumped over their wall and into their backyard. What the hell was she doing? I went up to the gate and rang the doorbell. This colored kid answered.
May I help you? He said.
Yeah, my dog is in your yard.
What?
My dog, she's in your yard.
Fufi walked up and stood between us.
Fufi, come, I said. Let's go.
The kid looked at Fufi and called her by some other stupid name, Spotty or some bullshit like that.
Spotty, go back inside the house.
Whoa, whoa, I said. Spotty, that's Fufi.
No, that's my dog, Spotty.
No, that's Fufi, my friend.
No, this is Spotty.
How could this be Spotty? She doesn't even have spots. You don't know what you're talking about.
This is Spotty.
Fufi.
Spotty.
Fufi.
Of course, since Fufi was deaf, she didn't respond to Spotty or Fufi. She just stood there. I started cursing the kid out.
Give me back my dog.
I don't know who you are, he said, but you better get out of here.
Then he went into the house and got his mom, and she came out.
What do you want? She said. That's my dog. This is our dog. Go away.
I started crying.
Why are you stealing my dog?
I turned to Fufi and begged her.
Fufi, why are you doing this to me? Why, Fufi, why?
I called to her. I begged her to come. Fufi was deaf to my pleas and everything else. I jumped onto my bike and raced home, tears running down my face. I loved Fufi so much. To see her with another boy, acting like she didn't know me, after I raised her, after all the nights we spent together, I was heartbroken. That evening, Fufi didn't come home. Because the other family thought I was coming to steal their dog, they had decided to lock her inside so she couldn't make it back the way she normally did to wait for us outside the fence. My mom got home from work. I was in tears. I told her Fufi had been kidnapped. We went back to the house. My mom rang the bell and confronted the mom.
Look, this is our dog.
This lady lied to my mom's face.
This is not your dog. We bought this dog.
You didn't buy the dog. It's our dog.
They went back and forth. This woman wasn't budging. So we went home to get evidence, pictures of us with the dogs, certificates from the vet. I was crying the whole time, and my mom was losing her patience with me.
Stop crying. We'll get the dog. Calm down.
We gathered up our documentation and went back to the house. This time, we brought Panther with us as part of the proof. My mom showed this lady the pictures and the information.